hey, it's the guy who made The Thing, but not this thing. In honor of Wolf of Wall Street, what's your favorite cameo by a director not in that director's film?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with Tyler Perry in the first Star Trek, because that is a bold move on all parts.
It's me, David the Seven, Kevin Smith in Wes Craven's Scream 3, because I'm glad those characters exist in a universe where Alanis Morissette is a god.
I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to go with Sofia Coppola in Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, because she looks like Natalie Portman.
What? If I ever knew about that, I've forgotten. I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going to go with Werner Herzog in What Dreams May Come, because when Robin Williams says, Papa, and he goes, my son, I can't do it, but it's amazing. It's on YouTube. You need to watch it.
Sofia Coppola plays one of Padme's impersonators.
Isn't that Keira Knightley?
And it's Keira Knightley also.
That's fucked up, man.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 4 for Tuesday, December 17th, 2013. Happy holidays. Please keep giving us your reviews on iTunes. Please keep subscribing. Keep up the good work. It's been a good couple weeks. Thanks a lot.
Shake that body, party that ball. Shake that body, party that ball. Shake that body, party that ball. Come and have a good time with
G.O.P. I believe there's a God above me. I'm just the God of everything.
So, it's that annual time where Dave talks about South Park and makes everybody think that it's relevant, or at least that's my goal, because I feel like once again, at the end of this season, Trey Parker and Matt Stone have pulled something at least semi-culturally relevant in the area of satire off for their final episode of the season called The Hobbit, which, I guess to briefly explain it, there's a cheerleader named Lisa Berger, and Wendy Testerberger, who's another cheerleader, tries to make her feel better about her body image by showing her that people that she idolizes, like Kim Kardashian on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, are really more of a product of a media portrayal that can be photoshopped. But Lisa takes this the wrong way and uploads a Photoshop picture of her, which the boys in the school then take to be a reality. And it becomes both a repetition joke with the word jelly and sort of a serious discussion of, I guess, avatars amongst young girls and maybe just young children in general.
And but also including cameos from Kanye West, which is its own kind of repetition joke.
Including cameos by Kanye West trying to convince people that Kim Kardashian is not a hobbit, which gives the episode its title. But also notable is that it is the second South Park season finale ever to sort of end on a downer note, with Wendy eventually giving in to the peer pressure, which I thought was very interesting because it's, I guess, it's interesting because South Park usually tries to pride itself on not taking a position one way or the other, but usually the position that defaults to is this is what's stupid and this is what isn't stupid, and very rarely is that this is something bad, but it's something we can't change and we're sort of just culturally frustrated by it. And they did it similarly with a previous season finale called You're Getting Old, where Stan just starts realizing that everything around him is shit, and it was sort of a meta-commentary on South Park running out of ideas. So not only is it interesting sort of as a satire show on the digital avatars of young children, but I think it's also, to a modicum amount, or in a, however you use the word modicum in that sentence, to a small amount, also about making this show in the marathon schedule like South Park does. We're sort of like towards the end of certain seasons recently, Trey and Matt have seemed to have gotten kind of tired and in a more depressing, more biting satirical mood. And sometimes it outputs something that's outside of the series' usual dick jokes and broad cultural metaphors. Am I alone in this?
Well, I'm a... Every episode of South Park was like this. I feel like I would watch it because, like you say, no one ever talks about it until you do, and I really like this episode. But why do they do this to burn themselves out like that? They can do, I assume, literally whatever they want. They've structured the entire show so that it's like that. Why do they feel the need to do it that way?
I mean, this is the first season that actually it has failed them, where a power outage at South Park Studios delayed.
Yeah, but it failed them in like an awesome way. That rules. That is the case. That like an episode of television would have to be canceled because the lights went out for a day. That's awesome. That's very punk.
I mean, it allows them to be very responsive, and then also to a certain degree sort of keeps them, I guess, fresh. As something with animation, especially animated comedy, there's sort of a tendency to make it... Recently, it's been making it about arguing, but back in the Simpsons phase, it used to be making it about packing a whole bunch of jokes in because you had the capability to do that and change the lip sync at the like right point. So it's interesting to see South Park taking it more from, I think, like an emotionally raw thing where it's just sort of out there as a rough draft and therefore occasionally becomes more, I don't know, poignant.
But I mean, this episode wouldn't work 6 months from now. Like, you wouldn't be able to turn it around. It wouldn't be as poignant, I don't think, if it wasn't coming off. Not if it wasn't coming off like Bound 2 and, you know, the Kanye video that just came out with Kanye.
The Kanye video thing is funny, but I don't think... I mean, like, the famous Kim Kardashian selfie that it's referencing happened months ago. And that's the kind... I mean, that issue is something that comes up over and over again anytime there's some...
Yeah, but, like, we need Bound 2 to kind of... I mean, that's part of the twist of Kim Kardashian. I mean, she's back in the conversation now.
She'll be back in the conversation again. Like, in the next couple of years, there will be no limit of opportunities to have Kim Kardashian in the conversation. That's what she exists to do.
Maybe, but I also think if you're going to collide it with something like The Hobbit, as silly as that, I mean, it just seems like an opportunity that only a show that is created in a week's time could really
sure. And they had the Pope joke where he's named as the Man of the Year, and that's super timely and also really funny.
And they're the only ones who can push it that far. It's very R-rated. The Simpsons will never be that. And I think and the urgency allows them to do that, to be really harsh in their commentary. But wait, Dave, what I think is interesting here is that you're looking past the obvious thematic or the obvious satire here, and kind of reading it as an episode commentary on the making of the show, which I feel maybe
I said modicum. I struggled a lot to say modicum, like in a small amount.
I see what you're saying. I definitely see this as like a kind of how far can we attack things and how far can we criticize before we just give up because no one's listening and kind of just go along with pop culture. How much do you push before you give up and be exhausted and go home? But I think it's interesting, the female perspective here and the image problem, or if it is a problem. I mean, does Wendy walk away at the end of this episode knowing she's indulging in a problem, or is she going with the tides and becoming – I mean,
no,
is this a fight worth having?
She's incredibly sad about it. She's sad that she's given up. But I like the way that they had that in addition to a genuinely touching moment with Kanye West, the reformed gay fish, reading the story about why he loves Kim Kardashian even though she's actually a hobbit. Like, it's so stupid, and the running joke has been so silly, and I laughed every time. And then there's a really – I don't know. It does that balance really nicely.
That makes you wonder if what Kim Kardashian does, what Wendy is protesting throughout this episode, is actually as bad as Wendy thinks it is.
See, that's sort of where I came at it, where to me the really interesting thing about the Wendy storyline is how she keeps coming up with something that's morally responsible but keeps being labeled a hater, which I think is definitely the modern take on this sort of traditional like image thing. Like, no one's surprising me by telling me little girls are, you know, being wrongly influenced by media in today's, you know, Photoshop reality. But the idea that the truth could so quickly be labeled as jealousy or being quote-unquote a hater, I thought was very relevant.
Is it more commentary on the Jezebel age, where every day is a new argument with the same kind of sentiment and the same... I mean, it doesn't feel as dense or well-researched or as poignant because they're just kind of churning out the same argument. Their content is social change and an argument against Kim Kardashian's the world and image problems, and they keep stuffing it down our throats. I mean, they end up looking like haters and they dilute the market. They dilute the conversation, and suddenly, you know, we just have to go with the flow. Like, no one cares about Wendy's protest because she keeps saying it and she's not adding anything to the conversation. She is Jezebel in some ways.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Why is Kanye West a gay fish?
Oh, that's from the episode Gay Fish that was the Kanye West episode.
That's from, like, years ago. I remember
I have
that.
To admit, I was a little confused watching this episode. I didn't understand what was happening at all. I felt very old. And I didn't find the gender commentary to be particularly inspired. And I...
Even with the way that it ended?
I mean... I guess. I thought it was funny when they mocked Bound 2, but it just seemed a little bit surface level. You know, no pun intended. It's not even – I don't even know if pun is the accurate way of classifying that. But and also I had no idea what the fuck was happening. It was like I was watching – I felt like I was watching an episode of a serialized show.
Wait, how did you not – I mean, I haven't watched the show in years and years. But I had no figuring out what was going on.
I, like, was scarred by how awful South Park was. Like, I thought it was – South Park was terrible. And I could not deal with everyone coming out of the woodwork being like, hey, did you see South Park last night? And so I just shut it out of my life. I just don't.
You're a hater.
I just don't deal
with
South Park.
You're jelly. You're just jelly.
I'm very jelly.
Yeah.
I thought that was mildly amusing. But I'm just bringing this up not to be a hater or be jelly, but just to genuinely get to the bottom of what the fuck this Kanye West is a gay fish thing is about.
Dave, do you want to explain Kanye West is a gay fish?
No, not really. That episode is available for free on SouthParkStudios.com.
That whole, like,
but the
self-satisfaction
point being,
with that own in-joke of theirs was sort of emblematic of why I don't watch that show. But anyway, we're getting off track.
I agree we're getting off track because it seems like South Park, in the middle of a season where they had another three-part episode that I'm sure will be sold as a DVD and actually ended up sort of plugging their video game they have coming out, which had its own merits. I'm not necessarily knocking that, but what I'm saying is in a typical South Park season, I was very happy that they tossed off this thing that I think achieved true satire again, and I think that's how South Park is best.
Do you think there's any chance of them hitting a level of creativity like they've had before, or is it the best you can hope for kind of occasional flashes of this?
I mean, it's the way they produce it. You never know from week to week, so that at least keeps you watching. So I think it's a wash.
Katie, I don't want to end this conversation without hearing you comment on the female perspective here.
Oh, because I'm a woman?
Yes. If I'm going to like question the Jezebel method of discussing a serious topic that should be discussed and should be questioned, I mean, I'm criticizing Jezebel for diluting the conversation, doing it kind of poorly, but...
Yeah,
I feel
really
maybe I'm out of my element.
I mean, you can talk about football players raping women over and over again, and it gets exhausting, but you have to keep talking about it. And something like this is kind of the same thing. I mean, Jezebel has actually done really interesting things regarding photoshopping, like printing pictures, the unphotoshopped pictures, and comparing them to the actual covers. Like they did this with.
But
the
how do we go?
Cover.
How do they go beyond being haters? Or is that a problem
I mean,
with the
barely
community?
I don't really know how you're describing that as haters. Like,
I single out Jezebel because they are so often the people I see them both being linked to because they're covering really interesting comments, and then I see people criticizing what they end up going after. A lot of people will tweet out negative links and be like, oh my god, Jezebel's up to it again. You know, they're going crazy. They're attacking every possible issue that or non-issue sometimes, and maybe that's what Wendy does in this episode a little bit. She can't see that how this is helping certain people in a positive
sure. I mean, I don't really want to couch her as being Jezebel, mostly because I don't really read Jezebel that much anymore, but
I'm using them as a stand-in.
I know, and I don't find it that helpful. I find it really, I mean, I was along with the episode and the points that it made. I was kind of with Wendy with, you know, both when she was rallying against Photoshop and when she was, you know, learning that it's nice to be a hobbit who can make herself look beautiful. I thought what was more interesting, even in the body image stuff, was these kids walking around with the phones who were kind of walking with their actual girlfriends, but looking at the pictures and be like, no, she looks like this, and not looking her in the eye. And that seemed more emblematic of, you know, speaking of feeling old, it seemed like much more what it's like to be in high school or to be a kid now and to see everything, even like see people who you see every day, but see them mostly as computer avatars. But the body image stuff, I mean, it made sense to me. Those are arguments I've seen before. I thought it was interesting to see it from an unabashedly feminist perspective on a show like South Park, which I think is such a boy show. So I was glad that it existed.
Uh-huh, honey. All the mother niggas lame and you know it now. When a real nigga hold you down, you supposed to drown. Bam.
As you listen to this, it's Tuesday. We were recording this on Sunday when we have learned that Peter O'Toole has died. Also, Joan Fontaine has died, which is a really weird coincidence of two important actors dying on the same day. But we wanted to talk about Peter O'Toole briefly, mostly because we all have relatively recent experiences with Lawrence of Arabia, which is probably his most famous role. It's this
yes, all
huge...
four of us.
Sorry, Dave?
All four of us have had relatively recent experiences with Lawrence of Arabia.
I apologize.
That's okay.
And David.
I shut up just
have
so
you
I
ever
can do this
have
gotcha
you ever seen
moment.
Lawrence of Arabia?
I have seen Lawrence of Arabia. It's great.
See?
Just not in the awesome way we're going to talk about it. So I'm putting in my two cents now.
Well, I don't really want to talk about it in too much. And like, you know, I mean, we have Patches and David and I all managed to see it in 70mm, which is the way to see it. But basically, I find Lawrence of Arabia the kind of movie you have to sell people on because it's 4 hours and, you know, about a war nobody ever remembers. But this seemed like a good as opportunity as any to talk about that and why it's worth seeing and why Peter O'Toole mattered so much as an actor. David, you saw it the most recently. Lawrence of Arabia worked for you, yes?
Yes, very, very well indeed. And
did it work for you?
It worked very
well.
It worked
very well. No,
I think it holds up.
Just said no and see where that led.
I mean, I always feel somewhat ill-equipped to talk about actors, particularly after their deaths. It's the rare actor that I form any sort of personal attachment to, and Peter O'Toole was not one of them. Even though I recognize his greatness, certainly in that role and in other parts which he's famous, like Stuntman, and even as recently as Venus. In The Ruling Class, which is sort of an underseen classic that Criterion rescued from oblivion a few years ago, which I love. It's a crazy, eccentric British film from the 1973, I think. But, yeah, I don't know. I think he was a phenomenal actor. He lived life to the hilt, it seems, and said farewell to his acting career last year, I believe, in a statement that seemed to characterize him perfectly. And, you know, it's sad that people die sometimes.
Patches, do you have anything to add?
That was really profound.
It's sad when people die.
Thank you. I just like, at least speaking to Peter O'Toole, I mean, he's a guy that can do Lawrence of Arabia. He's also a guy who could do Supergirl. You know, And Man of La Mancha. Man of La Mancha is a very silly movie that Peter O'Toole can sell because he can be very silly. He can kind of play all the cards. And that's why I adore him. I think that's all I have. I think he's a wonderful guy.
I'm going to read his retirement statement that David referenced because it seems worth noting. It is time for me to chuck in the sponge, to retire from films and stage. The heart for it has gone out of me. It won't come back. My professional acting life, stage and screen, has brought me public support, emotional fulfillment, and material comfort. It has brought me together with fine people, good companions, with whom I've shared the inevitable lot of actors. Wait, with whom I've shared the inevitable lot of all actors, flops and hits. However, it's my belief that one should decide for oneself when it's time to end one's stay, so I'll bid the profession a dry-eyed and profoundly grateful farewell. We should all be so lucky to end our podcasting careers on such nice notes.
Was that the end of...
No, go for it.
I remembered actually something that I do have a Peter O'Toole connection to, which is I'm something of a Sherlock Holmes buff, and he was the voice of an animated Sherlock Holmes, I think.
Hey.
But I just remember that because, yeah, Sherlock Holmes is awesome.
But what about Joan Fontaine, Dave?
I mean... Joan Fontaine also had an awesome career. She retired far less recently.
You win
recently.
This round, de Havilland.
Yeah, if you have never read about her feud with her sister, Olivia de Havilland, it is amazing, and the details are fantastic. I hope that now that... rest in peace, Joan Fontaine, but maybe this will occasion some more details to come out because they had a really spectacular feud.
Now the sad part is, as we go back to watch Joan Fontaine and Olivia de Havilland movies, we'll realize that barely any of them are probably available to watch.
Well, I mean, they both had careers in the sound era. I mean, Joan Fontaine's most famous movie is Rebecca, which is definitely available. And she's the only actor to have won an Oscar for being in a Hitchcock movie, which is a crazy fact.
This is a great time to dredge up some lost stuff, though. This is where the weird lost stuff comes to light in the post-mortem part of an act. That is... really dour. I am sorry I brought that up.
Well, the good news is the only Joan Fontaine movie on Netflix instant watch is The Duke of West Point, which is...
Oh, a famous one, I'm sure.
but maybe not the best.
Yeah.
Certainly notable. But
yeah, go to your local video store and catch up on movies by these people. It's a good opportunity to go dig back into some old awesome
movies.
Stuff.
Yeah, go to
those
local
are the
video
things
store.
We movies. Watch in between Star Wars rumors.
In between episodes of Scandal.
Zing-a-ding.
This week for segment three, we're going to be talking about holiday movies, or in the case of my people, the Jews, a lack thereof. One of the things that, you know, I was one of the only Jewish kids in my school growing up, and one of the things around Christmas time that always made me feel most isolated from the whole Christmas experience, especially as we grew a little bit older and we started to get a little bit more of a base of pop culture knowledge was a lack of movies. Like, I have never seen A Christmas Story. I'm never going to see A Christmas Story at this rate. There are a lot of Christmas classics that you could probably quote from start to finish that I have never seen just because they were not mandatory institutions in my house. And we didn't really have any alternatives. I mean, you can watch Fiddler on the Roof for something Jewish, but it's not really a traditional...
Such a holiday
exactly. It's not
movie.
Really a traditional Hanukkah movie.
Are you not a fan
There's
of Eight
Crazy,
Crazy
Nights,
Nights
which
yeah.
is what everyone cites, and fuck you, Adam Sandler, for just trying to own that niche and be dumb with it. But I think, you know, everyone knows that it's a pretty awful movie. And so I've always, you know, I've sort of, you know, this is not like a deep wound for me or anything, but I've definitely...
I don't know. If you talk about it on the podcast, you must
as
mean
it. A cinephile who is Jewish, this is definitely something that occurs to me at the very least every year. And
don't you just watch Showa on Hanukkah?
We just watch Showa because that's really the spirit of Hanukkah. They tried to kill off the Jews, and we, like a burning candle, just hung in there for far longer than anybody expected.
You guys did it.
And you thought that movie was only going to last for an hour, but it lasts for eight. So there's Showa.
So David, I'm curious, like, you as a movie watcher, you have, I mean, Christmas is a holiday. You don't have to go to work. What do you do on, do you watch
do you
any movies?
Jews go to the movies day.
We just... We narcotize ourselves and just hope to sleep until it's the 26th.
You wrap up in blankets.
My plan for Christmas this year is to find a good repertory movie that's playing somewhere in the city and then go to my sister's apartment for dumplings. So, yeah.
That sounds Old very boy. Jewish, actually. Movies and Chinese food.
It's very traditional. I was thinking about this in context of the new Tyler Perry movie, Madea's Christmas, and just thinking, which I haven't seen and, you know, will not see.
But Patches has.
And he will, you know, we can talk about that. I'm actually really interested in his thoughts about it. But I was just thinking about how the exclusivity of these holiday movies, how they're packaged, if there could ever be a Hanukkah movie, even though I'm less interested in that genuinely because I think realistically unless the Coen brothers do it, there's probably not too much of an audience or a clamor for that. But I was just interested in the holiday movies as a whole, and I think so many of them, because of the nature of the holiday and tradition, how rooted it is in revisiting older films, there's obviously not quite the same push to make new iterations of these films like there are for some other annual events. And I wonder if they're... if we've given up on the idea of creating new holiday classics, or if something like Die Hard becomes sort of a holiday classic through the back door, where it's not really intended as such, but like where, you know, It's a Wonderful Life is really, I don't know, designed for that in mind.
So are you looking for secular holiday classics, like stuff that takes place at Christmas but isn't?
Well, it's like Love Actually has become a holiday classic because it's really, even though it's so Christmas-oriented, think, you know, obviously being a romantic comedy, it has inroads for a secular audience. But I'm just sort of curious as to how would Hollywood go about calculating, you know, a new holiday classic? What is it like? How does Madea do it?
I think the how does that's assuming that Madea does it.
What can we learn from Madea?
Nothing. Madea is the opposite of what you're talking about. In my opinion, it's an anti-Christmas movie because it kind of touts. It teaches values of lying and blackmail and violence, physical violence.
Are you
violence.
Saying Madea is fighting the war on Christmas?
No. Well, she is fighting. This is a retaliation to the war on Christmas, the liberal war on Christmas, because a Madea Christmas is all about making Madea. Sure that Jesus is all over Christmas conversation.
Did you laugh once in this
corporate
movie?
America? What?
Did you laugh once in this movie?
Madea is a funny character. I'm sorry.
Madea.
I'm going to say that. And she is funny. And actually, Larry the Cable Guy is probably the shining star.
The only part I saw was in the commercial where she's like, did you hear the one about the black guy and the rabbi or whatever who shot the guy who tells the joke? And I was like, not for me.
Hilarious. She recounts the nativity.
Madea loves violence.
Yeah, she tells the nativity story to a group of children, and she drops Mary J. Blige instead of Virgin Mary. Very funny. No, actually, Madea is a good character.
Madea.
I could see her being in a Seth Rogen movie, like a Judd Apatow snappy comedy, and it would be – the material just is very poor, and the story is saccharine and bullshit. But what you're speaking to, David, is very interesting because I think we're a little too far – we can't drop the cynicism today in Hollywood, and – I just did a very taxing top 100. This is not something of what I usually do, but I did a top 100 Christmas movies for Nerve.com. And that was a horrifying experience because there are barely 100 Christmas movies. And most of the ones at the top are, of course, these classics that we adore. And I think the most modern one in the top 20 might be Elf or A Muppet Christmas Carol, because these movies can drop the cynicism. They can be about the joys of the holiday. And maybe why we don't get Hanukkah movies is because the iconography isn't there. Because
no one cares.
Center a movie. Well, there's nothing
Jews
to kind of...
Jews run Hollywood, as we all know.
Yeah, but
oh, boy.
Okay.
What a claim.
Well, I was going to say something in response to that only I am allowed to say, but I'm just
I have nothing to add to that.
But, a nicer way of framing it would be that I think the people who run Hollywood, whatever faith they may subscribe to, are shrewd enough to understand that there is not much money to be made in Hanukkah movies. And frankly, I think a lot of Jews would agree with me that Hanukkah is sort of bullshit. I mean, it really feels – Hanukkah as we know it is sort of bullshit. And I think the story of the Maccabees and whatnot has some sort of religious importance.
Christmas,
but how we've appropriated – Christmas, of course, is plenty of bullshit.
Christmas is bullshit, but at least it has identifiable – icons.
And
it has
the difference is that Christmas it's built around fundamentally the most important event in Christian theology, whereas Hanukkah, even for I think religious scholars and rabbis and whatnot, would concede that the miracle of the oil lasting for 8 days and the Maccabees and whatnot, it's just not – it's a minor event, and it was inflated commercially Hanukkah some sort of commercial force to it. But
but a movie could make that. That's why a fiction movie could say, well, this is a really important holiday, and we're going to pretend like Jews get together for Hanukkah and, feel the family vibe and feel love and reinvest in joy. You could have a Christmas Carol version of Hanukkah where you have a grumpy guy who doesn't want to celebrate Hanukkah with his family. And then
the way around this would be in adapting a Hanukkah story. There's a great Hanukkah book, probably the only Hanukkah book I've read, to be fair, called Herschel and the Hanukkah Goblins.
Oh, this is the Goblins.
I've heard of this.
Talked about it on the podcast before. It's like a storybook.
I think last year you did.
Yeah. Anyway, it's amazing, and they would make if Laika, the stop motion people who did Coraline and Paranorman, this would be like the greatest animated movie anyone's ever seen.
I don't understand why there aren't Passover movies, because people do get together for Passover. I mean, this is getting away from the Hanukkah topic, but that seems like such an obvious pick for Jewish, like the Jewish version of the family stone.
We already have a Rugrats episode for that,
there's a Rugrats episode about Passover.
Are you kidding? Yeah, Rugrats was the Pickle family were Jews, so they had a Passover episode.
It's great.
They have a Hanukkah episode.
Guys, we're looking at this all entirely in the wrong way. It's not about religion. Can you name me a good Christmas movie besides the speech Linus gives in Charlie Brown Christmas that is actually about Jesus?
But is Christmas actually about Jesus anymore? I mean, for our
No, but that's what
and,
I'm saying.
And
that's
when
what,
you say that Christmas
you don't get
is the
any...
most important event in Christianity, it's really Easter, which has become totally separated
Stop
from
Stop making it about religion, Katie.
Care.
No, no more religion. That's not what holiday movies are about. That's not what good holiday movies are about. David, you not seeing The Christmas Story or, you know, Nash Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Those
I've never
movies
even
are about
heard
family.
Of that movie.
They're
you
not
just made
about...
it up.
No, it's one of the greatest Christmas movies. Anyway, that's not important.
It's about... A Wonderful Life actually secular? I mean, we see angels.
I would argue. I don't think it's explicitly
No, but it's been co-opted by you fuckers.
It is about Christmas, kind of.
No, it's not. It's about the fact that Christmas is towards the end of the year, and that's a time that we're all stuck in this horrible weather and thinking about the year past and trying to take a grander view on our life and our family and what's really important. It has absolutely nothing to do
like New
with
Year's
Hanukkah
Eve,
or Christmas.
The movie.
Just like New Year's Eve, the movie.
Yeah, exactly like New Year's Eve, the movie. So putting the word Christmas in, if that's driving off Jews, that's really horrible because most good Christmas movies aren't about Jesus.
Let me tell you, it says a lot more about the movies and the culture than it does about the Jews, because we want to watch these movies. It's Christmas. We want to go to the movies. It's what we do.
Wait, but you don't know Jews who watch A Christmas Story?
Of course I do. And of course, you know, I'm just saying that I think my experience of it not being such an intrinsic part of my childhood and my sort of movie vocabulary is somewhat typical. And that we definitely feel like I feel, and again, like I'm someone who, you know, watches movies for, you know, a living, and it's like it's such a big part of my life that this is like a whole genre that I just like don't have access to. And there's the reality of the situation, and then there's sort of the residue of it that's just sort of like the emotional feeling of it that I just feel like, yeah, why bother? It's not for me. You know, it's like I don't know.
Is there an experience that hurt you? Is there a Christmas movie that was too much about Jesus?
No, but it's not. But
there's no movies.
But Dave,
that fit
you're,
that.
I think you're mistaken in thinking that even going back to me being a kid, it was never like, oh, you believe in different religious iconography than I do. Like that's what makes me feel isolated. It's not that at all. It was the fact that you know, bring out your violins. But it was, you know, it's all in service to this holiday and on these various traditions that I will never get to take part in, or really, you know, it's the
but
whole
that's,
spirit
I
of
totally
it.
Disagree
to
with
do
that
with Jesus.
Yeah,
but I totally disagree with that, because Hanukkah ends up still being about giving, because it's now a gift giving holiday.
Listen,
so, and
all I
most
can do
of these
is
movies,
you can't distill it to anything rational or anything. I mean, rational maybe, yes, actually. But I mean, you have to understand that
I'm more confused
you
why
know,
you can't make Hanukkah movies, because it's about giving, and most of these movies are. You know, A Christmas Carol is about giving yourself over to the holidays and being compassionate for humans and wanting to give.
Because
and that's what the holiday ends up being all about, or even
money,
these old movies.
And no one – you cannot – and I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying you're not going to see a Love Actually type film that says 4 weeks to Hanukkah. Or like, you know, it's
– oh, God, I would love that.
Yeah, maybe Hanukkah's just too long to have a movie, yeah. You know. One night – it's Christmas night. It's Christmas Eve, mm-hmm. Whereas Hanukkah's like 8 days of this
Patches,
shit.
You may say that with tongue-in-cheek, but I think there's some truth to that.
I'm serious. Yeah. I mean, it's dramatically more interesting to have a single day holiday than it is to have something that's 8 days.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or maybe
I mean,
you
like,
had to.
We
you know, there's a Jonathan
the...
Taylor Thomas movie where he has to get home in time for Christmas. That could have been a Hanukkah movie. 8 days. I have to get home for at least the last day of Hanukkah. He could have crossed.
It could be, but it obviously feels less urgent if it's like, well, you know, you got there's 7 days of Hanukkah already. It's no biggie.
Yeah.
You know,
next year.
So, David, are you as interested as I am in this potential Seder movie?
The what?
You're obsessed with Passover.
No, because that seems like the logical Jewish holiday to structure one of these movies
around. I'm not sure if I can reconcile this in a way that makes sense. But I feel the absence of Hanukkah movies, but I don't necessarily care or want them. I just I don't, you know, I really don't need a Hanukkah movie to show my kids or or, you know, to somehow write the balance, because it's not going to happen. I think that, you know, Jews that I know, at least myself included, have this weird sort of pride in being in the minority in that respect. When we're not being persecuted, you know, when it comes to innocent things like holiday movies, we're okay with it. I don't feel the need for it. I just wonder. I don't know. I was just like, how I think I was more interested in this conversation about like how you make these new holiday movies. Like, if the tone of the culture has changed in a way that you can make these classics in a way, or these future classics, with the same, you know, reliability or resonance that you could back then. And if cynicism is such a big part of it, and if a Madea movie is cynical, despite the fact that it's inevitably saccharine at the end.
Well, I mean, having not seen Madea, I'm not sure I should field this, but I feel I'm going to try, because I saw Elf, which I think Patch has named as possibly the most recent classified as classic holiday movie. I saw that with my brother when I was really recently moved to New York, and we were having sort of a Thanksgiving Christmas time without our parents before going home and delving into the family. And it really, you know, ended up being, I guess, uncynical, which is not what I was necessarily expecting from Will Ferrell, who could always ended up being uncynical. But at that time, it was sort of unclear how that was going to pan out.
That whole movie is sort of a reaction or rebuttal to cynicism, right? I mean, like, rooted in the main character is this guy who's he lives in a cynical world. He comes into a cynical world, rather, and James Caan is nothing if not a cynical man. And he is this guy who's incapable of cynicism. And so I think the movie is able to sort of find a loophole there, because it is explicitly about the resistance to cynicism.
I mean, I would say almost that that is what I would define as a movie that you can watch, like, as a family movie in a holiday in the broadest terms, is you don't want to have it be cynical in any sort of way. So you could, you know, get together and watch, you know, Avatar, if that's what your family's into, but just something that everybody could get around with and be just that bland holiday spirit that's everything's going to be better. But I think that's what hurts, you know, that's why when people bring up Adam Sandler as the only person doing Hanukkah media, that's why it hurts, is because Adam Sandler movies and Adam Sandler joke songs are to a certain degree about cynicism that I think doesn't really resonate.
I think that's why the original 1947 Miracle on 34th Street is my favorite Christmas movie, because it is about the cynicism that plagues Christmas and the commercialism, obviously. And it's literally attacking that guy.
You know what my
attacking
favorite...
Attacking the spirit of Christmas.
And I think this could maybe wrap up the conversation, but my favorite Christmas scene in a movie, and I think this this sort of is emblematic of my experience maybe, or captures it, is in Catch Me If You Can, when he calls Tom Hanks. Leonardo DiCaprio calls Tom Hanks on Christmas Eve because he has nowhere to go. And Tom Hanks is still at work in his office, and they have a little... They have the spirit of Christmas, as Patch has described it, in a non-secular way between the two of them.
I'm always a sucker for that kind of the idea of Christmas is the time when you find the people who you care about and you know, give them a hug, or you spend that time with them, which Love Actually does. I mean, it is as modern as Elf. It came out on the same day, weirdly enough. But it's all about that kind of lack of need for cynicism. Like, you let down that wall, like when Bill Nye and his assistant kind of admit that they have been the loves of each other's lives or something. I don't know. Maybe it's that you're primed to want that time of year. But if it's well done, lack of cynicism in that way. And I think that the poor Christmas movies are the most cynical, because they're kind of trotting out that earnestness and only to get you to cry, and it doesn't feel earned at all.
That's
it works.
Yeah, that's the problem. You know, the most recent Christmas movies have been what? Christmas with the Cranks, Fred Claus, Four Christmases.
What
it
was
can't,
that one
it can't
with
boil
Matthew
down.
Broderick and Danny DeVito?
Oh, where they're warring across the lawns. I forget. But, I mean, you can't – the best Christmas movies boil it down to the confrontation of I'm a schmuck. I'm a stick in the mud. And this is what joyful Christmas is all about, like just being happy. And then these new modern Christmas movies are all about, like, it takes place at Christmas, but it's also this kind of movie, and it's also this. I mean, it's what plagues all Hollywood movies at this point.
And
it
and
seems
it's a lot
difficult
of, like,
to picture a movie being like Miracle of 34th Street today, you know, where it's just about Christmas and what that means.
Real quick before we wrap this up, do any of you have the movies that you do actually watch every Christmas? Like whether or not it's something you watch with your family, but is there something that feels like it embodies Christmas for you and it doesn't feel right if you don't watch it?
Yes. My family would frequently get together with our neighbor's family, which has been, I guess, since 1989. We watch National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation once a year. So,
nice.
Hey, David, you should check it out. It's on Netflix this year, so
it's
we all have it a whole
ABC
bunch
family
easier.
Really?
Constantly lately.
Yeah. Anybody else?
We are big Muppets people at my house. I think.
Yes.
Are you men
Muppets
or
Christmas
are you
Carol.
Muppets?
Never mention that movie to me, seriously. But Muppet Christmas Carol is an absolute favorite. But we also watch a VHS tape every year. We have a VHS television that lives in our basement that we have to like plug. Yeah, basically we have to plug it into a new television just to get the VHS player working. But it's this TV special called A Muppet Family Christmas, which I don't think is even on DVD anymore because Disney can't like get their shit figured out with the rights, because it's Fozzie's mom is about to go on vacation, but Fozzie surprises her with the whole Muppets gang. They all come over her house for Christmas, and then the Sesame Street gang shows up, and they all come.
Crossover episode.
Yeah, and they're having a huge party. It's a dinner, so it's like from scene to scene, just like random. They're singing songs and making dinner, and then the Fraggles show up. And then it's
wow.
like, this is getting serious. It's just
that's
a wonderful,
be a Jim Henson
like, cram everyone into a house. And that's what I love about Christmas, just getting
that's
family
amazing.
Together.
Yeah, I like, oh shit, I was, never mind. Someone jump in.
I have one. Both of my parents, but I think especially my dad, love White Christmas, the Bing Crosby musical movie. And it's about White Christmas, like in that part, but it's really about these guys being war veterans, and they find out their old general is kind of running this inn in Vermont, and he's kind of unhappy about the way that he's left things, and he's not in the position of power that he used to be. And it's about all these veterans getting together and honoring the returning man. It's this really interesting World War II era theme. And also the songs are awesome, and the costumes are great. And
I'm just glad that none of you said meet me in St. Louis.
Speak honestly. I hate White Christmas.
Oh, fuck.
I recommend Holiday Inn over White Christmas.
That is another one of my dad's favorites, but
stop
that one is
Holiday Inn actually debuted the song. It debuted Irving Berlin's White Christmas.
You know,
and then they repurposed it for the movie.
If it snowed in Rachel Getting Married, that would be a perfect choice. I think it's around
you actually, David, I think you are the star of the Hanukkah Christmas Carol, where like you're reinvigorated by the ghosts of Hanukkah past, and
I should be the main character
that are out there.
So is that now up to our listeners, someone who's an animator, to animate?
Well,
David's
it's true. Of all the people
Hanukkah
who would
Carol.
Star in a Hanukkah movie, I alone have the box office power to make this happen.
It'll be you and Werner Herzog.
Right. So look for that in the year 2015, the summer of 2015.
Goblins.
Someone make this trailer.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
That does it for this episode of Fighting in the War Room. It'll be our last regular episode for 2013. We've got some holiday programming. We've got some top tens planned. It's going to be a slightly different schedule, but lots of good stuff coming in the next couple weeks. So a happy end of 2013.
And one good riddance, am I right?
It was horrible. It was horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible. Across the board.
Happy first year of life to Fighting in the War Room. Anyway, we will be back on Friday. We'll be reviewing Anchorman 2. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
Yes, I am Matt Patches. I write on the internet at a number of websites that cover movies and pop culture, and I try and put it all on my website, mattpatches.com, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And remember, now that we are fighting in the war room, we have a website called fightingthewarroom.com, believe it or not. And Dave is actually doing an extraordinary job keeping it up to date and asking like survey questions and encouraging people to subscribe, and it's absolutely wonderful. So go there when we put out the episodes and check it out and answer his questions.
Yeah, give it up for Dave. Good work. Yay.
Oh, thanks everybody. This is my Christmas present. Just you guys all like
and Spider-Man is like my most anticipated movie of 2014.
That's your present day. Right.
That is literally unbelievable. Literally unbelievable.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior editor of Film.com. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and at Film, DOTCOM. And you can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room, which after you visit this wonderful site that they've made for us at fightinginthewarroom.com is the next best place to interact with us. Or maybe even the best place to interact with us, but not the best place to find
us. Or troll us on every platform.
Wow. Okay, I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spell that first part D-A-7-E, which is my Twitter handle. I also talk about superhero movie news, Latino-Review.com. A lot of big changes this year. I'll be wrapping up at the end of 2013. I'm drinking Bullet 95 Rye American Whiskey that did not pay us to advertise, but they really should anytime they feel
We accept any and all whiskey sponsorships.
Yeah, Bullet, or anybody that wants to pretend to be Bullet and ask a salient film question can call us at 914-410-6450. That is our voicemail.
I really want more phone messages. Like, that's what I want for Christmas.
Yeah. And the more awkward, the better.
Please call us after you've been drinking with your family. Tell us about your Christmas.
Call us from dinner.
Call us
while the family is at the table and leave.
Have
a message.
Your mom.
Everyone
call
should
us.
Get on the phone at least.
I'm gonna force my entire family when I see them over Christmas to leave us voicemails.
Yeah, I don't think we have a limit to our voicemails, so just go crazy. I mean, we have to listen to all of them, but that's really you're guaranteed we will waste some time listening to you. So call us 914-410-6450.
And I am Katie Rich. You can find me at Vanity Fair's Hollywood. Little plug, there's a Twitter feed at VF Hollywood. It needs some followers. It's new. It's getting up there. Please follow it. I tweet from it. You can also follow me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And you can follow this wonderful podcast, Fighting in the War Room, on Twitter at FITWR. And there you can answer this week's lightning round question, which is...
In honor of the Wolf of Wall Street, I'm going to rephrase this question because there's been some controversy.
You're bringing all podcast conversations onto the podcast.
We are looking. I know, but, you know, people like to hear us fighting, it turns out, once we put it in the title. So, Patches would like me to clarify that we are looking for a director that is on screen in a movie that he himself did not direct. So it is a director in a movie as an actor, but in a movie that he did not direct. So no Hitchcock cameos and Hitchcock films and all that.
Boom.
Bull.
Very complicated lightning round question, but worth answering.
It's not that complicated. Mm-hmm.
It will work out. I didn't think so. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you on Friday.
If he stays, I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm 1,000 pieces of glass. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm 1,000 pieces of glass. If he stays, I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm 1,000 pieces of glass. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm 1,000 pieces of glass.